Kari and I want to discuss classical Yang Mills with added hard thermal loops. And my part of it is going to be work done in collaboration, well, primarily with Bernd Mueller and Sharon Hu. And Kari hopefully will talk about work done in collaboration with Dietrich Bideker and with me. Now, what I want to do is very briefly explain what it is we want to do and why, which is that we want to understand in a non-perturbative way the evolution of Yang-Mills field equations, which are considered as a treatment of the infrared part of hot Yang-Mills field theory, augmented with hard thermal loop effective action, which is what you get when you integrate out the ultraviolet part where quantum effects are important. Now, to do that, I'm going to have to tell you how we do the Yang-Mills equations, and in particular, they have to be regulated so that they're only the infrared fields are appearing as fields in the Yang-Mills equations. And when I do that, I'm going to give a brief introduction to lattice methods for those people who don't know these things. So those of you who know all that stuff cold can tune out this part. And those of you who have always been wondering what we've been talking about will hopefully get some vague idea. And then I'm going to discuss how we add the hard thermal loops to the lattice Yang-Mills system, which is you can view as a particularly nice way of regulating the Yang-Mills field equations so that you really are only capturing the infrared, which is where classical field behavior should make sense. But then these hard thermal loops, that's adding back in things which you threw out so that instead you're integrating them out or considering them at leading order in perturbation theory. And time permitting, I'll mention briefly what we learned by doing this. And the emphasis of my talk is intended to be both technical and physical. So I want you to have an understanding of how the thing we're looking at is actually put together. Nuts and bolts, I'm not going to talk about what grade of steel the nuts and bolts are made out of and things like that, you know, but you should see where the individual nuts and bolts are. And I want to make contact between what's going on in the numerical model and what physically should be happening. And I want to make clear what physics it is that we want to be doing and how well we're doing it and in what ways we're doing it wrong. And I think in many respects the most convenient way to construct a model is to do so on the chalkboard so that you can see the pieces fit into place one by one. So that's my excuse for not having made a lot of overheads. It's not actually an excuse. I actually do think this is the way to do it. I won't go into great details about why what I'm about to say is justified, but what we want to look at is Yang-Mills field equations. The Yang-Mills field equations are Gauss's law. And whose law is this? It's Ampere Coulomb. Or Ampere Maxwell. Yeah, so anyway, the covariant divergence of the electric field is given by a charge density. And the time evolution of the electric field is given by the covariant derivative of the magnetic field and a current. And I hope I got all the signs right. But if I didn't, you know, just ignore signs for the duration of the talk. Okay. And if we're going to be talking about hot Yang-Mills theory, then using these fields is an appropriate thing to do if you're talking about the infrared Yang-Mills fields. It's not an appropriate thing to do when you're talking about the ultraviolet Yang-Mills fields. However, if you're talking about the ultraviolet Yang-Mills fields and fermions and gunk like that coupled to them, then they behave like a bunch, well, you can do a perturbative calculation and you find out that at leading order, they behave like a bunch of charged particles moving with relativistic dispersion relations, and receiving only small deflections, so that they almost move in straight lines. And then you can do a calculation which in real space tells you that Gauss's law is modified by a charge density which is given by an integral over the path light cone. So Gauss's law is a statement about how the divergence of the electric field is related to the charge density. The charge density at some point is given by an integral over the path light cone of how electric fields along the path light cone deflected charge carriers to send more of one charge than the opposite charge towards us. So if I had an electric field here pointing in this direction at this backwards time on the light cone, then if the electric field is pointing the way that I say it is, then a positively charged thing is going to get bent and move more toward us, and a negatively charged thing is going to get bent and move more away from us. And that means that there's going to be a current coming towards us due to this electric field, which will propagate, and since it's a non-abelian gauge theory, it's going to get parallel transported while it propagates. So there's a parallel transporter along the line from here to us. And it's going to arrive at us and be a charge density. It's also going to be a current. And the y hat here and the y hat here correspond to the projection of the electric field at the path point along the direction toward us, which tells how much, you know, if you had an electric field pointing this way, it would be deflecting things this, you know, back and forth, but it wouldn't be sending more or fewer things towards us. So that a projection operator, say, only electric fields pointing towards us or away from us matter. And in the current, these charged particles coming toward us arrive moving in this direction, since that's where they're coming from. And so they only contribute to the current moving in that direction, and that's what this projection operator is for. And there's a... Well, they're the Yang-Mills equations in the presence of charges and currents, and then the charges and currents are described by a bunch of classical particles, and I'm just walking through how the expressions... I mean, these can be formally derived diagrammatically and have been by...
But I see in D, that's already...
Okay.
Some concepts.
Okay, the divine mass squared here is basically counting how many charge carriers there are and how susceptible they are to being bent by an electric field. So right now for me that...
Sorry, it's a temperature dependent mass, which is...
Yeah, well, it's... What it actually is it's the number density of charge carriers. Times the... twice the mean value of the inverse energy of the charge density times the charge squared of a charge carrier. And it represents the polarizability of a plasma of particles. So yes, I'm already assuming that I have a plasma of particles at some temperature.
But this time it's absent if you don't have any fermion density.
No, it's in a Yang-Mills sealed equation, it's not absent because you still have hard gluons, which are joint charged particles. If you consider the infrared fields separately from the ultraviolet fields, then no. So implicitly, I'm sorry, implicitly, I am assuming that these, and this is an important point which I was going to make as soon as I finished explaining what the hell these gross expressions are. Implicitly, I'm assuming that I have regulated these fields to contain only infrared stuff. And the exact way that I'm going to regulate those to contain only infrared stuff is going to be the topic of a great deal of the talk. Having done that, then all the ultraviolet stuff should now be considered charged particles moving in the background of those infrared things. So I'm splitting off the ultraviolet part and sticking it over here as a charge density.
Right. This is a very interesting picture of the fast black cone, et cetera. But you are implicitly assuming that the particles are only accelerated or decelerated along this line. They do not change direction.
I'm assuming that their change in direction is small. No, I'm assuming their change in direction is small. And that's an appropriate approximation of leading order in the coupling. And as I said, you know, I'm trying to give some idea for where this comes from, but the real place that it comes from is you do a perturbative calculation and this is the thing that drops out. And it's frequently written, instead of having this integral over past light cone, you write it in a non-local way as 1 over V dot D of electric field. And this is the same thing. Okay.
Well, I have a question in that context also, but then probably coming back. The light cone in the field theory is relatively field theory. It's a very special object. And the hot particles really do not travel with the speed of light. They have a slight mass.
Yeah.
Okay,
so I just have to increase this a little bit. Increase the retardation a tiny little bit. I don't think it's going to change anything I say. Okay. And, you know, this would be actually very easy in the context of our thing to stick in a little mass. We could have done that if we had felt like it. No, it would be actually very easy to put back in.
But it's outside the whole scheme of approximation.
No, I think it would be. Yes, that's right. But if I, for instance, were interested in QCD, well, yeah. I mean, basically, I don't think we should bother. But if it were urgent, we could do it. But as we're going to see, there are other problems, which mean that if when I actually implement this thing, there are some other problems which are probably more important than that. But in a way related, because it's also a question of whether things propagate on the light cone. And the regulation of these will turn out to have some non-light cone propagation, which I'll come to. Okay, but anyway, the point is that what these represent is that they represent that you have a whole bunch of charged particles, an electric field polarizes them, and then they travel as currents, which show up later in Yang-Mills equations, and get parallel transported along the there. Trajectories.
In the formulation of Lazo and Yanko, you expect to have a distribution function of the charged particles. So
yeah, this has been been integrated over in finding the Debye mass. Yeah. So the Debye mass is actually an integral over all particles of the population function and one over the energy. It's varied in here.
The average over angular directions.
That's explicit. Yeah, basically.
Okay, so there's been some specs here.
They either have or haven't depending on, you know, you could say, okay, I do the integration, somebody else did it for me, thank you.
Okay.
Here's the answer. So these are the equations I'm trying to get.
Maybe one or two people who haven't gone.
Okay, sure. Okay, but. Okay, but the emphasis is that I'm going to try to.
Sorry, could you give us an expansion parameter? I mean, you want to drop it. It's already determined at some root.
Okay, it's an expansion in G squared H bar.
G squared?
Well, maybe G root H bar, I don't know.
G squared. So already the.
It's alpha weak.
Already the Debye mass is a complicated concept.
And you've integrated out the hard modes and written down an effective theory for the soft ones. So there's also some sort of derivative expansion to which external lines have to be soft relative to that.
I'm just trying to understand, with the gauge connector, which involves G, should that be now expanded or should that be kept to
all orders? No, it needs to be kept to all orders.
Okay.
Because it's going to be connecting points which are widely separated from each other.
Yeah.
If it were going to be.
No, so that's already a very dubious thing, isn't it? Because this is very. I mean.
No. It's not a dubious thing. Everything is fine.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what I was going to originally do is just say, okay, these are the things I want to do, and I hope you already all knew that.
Okay.
But
to just add one comment, I mean, there's G's that are in the soft part of the theory, and those you're just leaving out. That's the non-conservative effective. You're expanding in couplings that are affecting the dynamics of the hard particles on them. So, I mean, it all starts by saying take your degrees of freedom and split them. So those parallel transporters depend on the
soft stuff.
Field.
Yeah. Oh. This expression is dissipative. The noise represents that in addition to mean values of initial particle populations, initial particle populations have fluctuations. And this noise is just those fluctuations and what they do. And I don't have to write down what it is because there's only one thing it could be in order that this has the correct thermodynamics. So it's the thing which gives the right thermodynamics. And in practice, it turns out when I try to implement the thing, it's easiest to make sure that I get this right and that I get the thermodynamics right, and then I know that I've gotten that right because it's uniquely fixed by the requirement I have correct thermodynamics. Okay, and now as I said, I have to somehow regulate these guys, and I have to then somehow implement these guys on top of that regulation. So first I'm going to discuss how I want to write down regulated classical Yang-Mills field equations.
Just one quick question, just to make sure I understand. When you say I get the thermodynamics right, you say I implement the fluctuation dissipation theorem or something?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So as it stands now, it's no more for the space, no more for the
space. Yes. And it will be the whole time.
Does March come from a good one on this
field? No, it reflects the fact that to write things this way, I have to have integrated out some degrees of freedom which have initial conditions. And the noise reflects my freedom of choice of those initial conditions. Okay, in my actual implementation, rather than integrating these out, I'm going to find something else to stick in there, which, if I integrated out, would also give these terms. And then the noise will explicitly appear as the initial conditions for that other thing that I'm going to have in there. But we'll come to that.
But it's a bit confusing because in the Bezel
and
Yang equation there is no noise.
So well, yeah, because, you know, they make mistakes. Everyone does. I think that they're interested in slightly different things. I mean they're interested in you start these guys out being much larger than thermal. Yeah, they start these guys out being much larger than thermal and they ask how do they evolve. And in that case, you don't have to worry about that. I'm interested in equilibrium, which I should comment on. I'm only talking about something which can be used, as far as I understand, to compute equilibrium but unequal time correlators. And if I'm going to be talking at a non-equilibrium workshop, then I can excuse that by saying that if you have that kind of correlators, then you can use fluctuation dissipation relations to relate them to some close to equilibrium, non-equilibrium quantities, which are the kinds of things that we're going to be interested in and are all that you can determine with this. For instance, you can relate the diffusion constant for Chern-Simons number to how baryons are produced when there's or how they're eaten up when there's an excess of baryons. And that's the particular application this has been used for, but there are others which I might have time to come to. So anyway, I should tell you how I'm going to regulate these Yang-Mills equations. And for the moment, I'm going to think about regulating them when there isn't a charge or current. And this is something that I'm just going to tell you about what Jan and collaborators did years ago, and it's all based on some ideas that Wilson had even many years before that. So, oh, and I should also mention that I could add Higgs's. I'm not going to write down what happens when you add Higgs's and what it looks like. It's a straightforward extension. And in practice, the way that you do it is that you have a line which says, and when you want to include Higgs's, all you do is you erase that and that. So it's really very easy to do it. And I'm not even going to bother going through the details.
And Jan provides you with the subroutine.
No, we all have to have our own code. I mean, you can never trust somebody else's code, right? Okay. So, what? Okay, so anyway, the basic idea of how I'm going to do the regulation is I'm going to do it in real space in a way which tries as hard as possible and succeeds to capture the geometrical meaning of Yang-Mills equations and, in particular, gauge invariants. So if I wanted to take a scalar field like the Higgs field and remove the ultraviolet degrees of freedom, I could think about only choosing to define it at a discrete set of points. And then the ultraviolet degrees of freedom are the fact that normally the field could have fluctuations in between those points, but if you only know the field values at these points, then such fluctuations can't make sense. Okay, so if I were implementing scalar field theory or O3 linear sigma model or something, then I could do it in this way. I could just define the field at these points. Okay. But now if I have a gauge field, it's not fair to compare phi here at x plus I with phi here at x, before you've told how you're going to relate the two by including a path for parallel transportation. So normally in the continuum, I could not compare this to this, and in particular, I couldn't write a derivative term in this theory. Before I told you, oh, I want to compare this to this by pulling it along this path to do the parallel transportation. And the parallel transportation is that this phi at x plus I hat would get hit by a path order exponential. This is going to have to be further over here, so of I integral AA mu TA D L mu along the path from here to here, which I've chosen, which I'll call a contour. So this is something which it's fair to compare to the field here. And that's what living in a gauge theory is all about. Okay? And now if you're going to tell me that I'm only allowed to define scalar fields as a discrete set of points, it's only fair for me to say, well, I'm lazy too. I only want to bother to define parallel transportation along some restricted set of paths. And the most natural restricted set of paths on a cubic lattice is that I only allow paths which run from a point to its nearest neighbor along a straight line. So now I say, in keeping with the idea of having a finite number of degrees of freedom, I'm going to specify how to perform parallel transportation from here to here along any path made up of a sequence of links, which are lines between nearest points. Okay, so A is not defined everywhere, but what is defined is the path ordered exponential of A on each one of these links. And I define this thing on a link of U as U of that link, which is an element of the group, which I'll write as SUN, but it's really SU2. What's wrong? Oh, okay. Okay, so I could have parallel transported along this path, but I'm no longer allowed to parallel transport along that path. And this restricts the number of gauge degrees of freedom by the appropriate amount so that I still have a finite number of degrees of freedom. And this is just the way to do it. Okay, and now what does gauge freedom mean? So there's a U here, and there's a U here, and there's a U on each one of these guys, which represents what you use to parallel transport from one end of it to the other end of it. Okay?
So the U's are your fundamental variable.
Yes. Well, I could say that A is the fundamental variable, but the only place that it ever appears is in this path ordered exponential, which gives you an element of SU2.
You need to know A values between the points you need to choose on.
Well, except that all I ever use is this integral, so I may as well only have that integral as a degree of freedom,
which
is to say I only have the U's. And it turns out that it would actually be dangerous to think that the A's are the things because you use the wrong measure if you do that. Using the U's gives you the right measure. Group measure. In particular, it gives you a group measure, which is gauge invariant, as I'll come to. Well, as I hopefully won't come to, because that's a pain. Okay. But now...
But you could have changed the measure to the A's. You changed to the method.
Yeah, I know. let's not talk about it. Okay. Now, what about gauge freedom? Gauge freedom is a statement, okay, I didn't mention what kind of an object this phi is. This phi is a complex fundamental, which if I'm an SUN actually has n components, but I'll just write 2 because I'm always thinking of SU2. Well, I'm usually thinking of SU2. Okay, and the statement of gauge invariance is that I ought to be able to do something to the theory which performs an arbitrary SU2 rotation on that, which I'll call lambda, without changing any physics. Okay, and usually the way that you manage to get that to happen in the continuum is you say, well, when I make this lambda, it also changes these A's. And so here on the lattice, if I wanted to make this lambda, then I'm also going to have to change the U's. And this one gets a lambda inverse, and this one gets a lambda. This one gets a lambda inverse. I always get it backwards. And this one gets a lambda. And if I change these U's in this way, and I change this phi in this way, then when I parallel transport it over to here to compare it to phi there, this lambda will get canceled by that lambda inversion. I'll get the answer that I'm supposed to. Nothing will have changed. It's when I compare it to this guy here, I'll see the same guy arise for comparison. And that also happens if I were to compare it along that path, because I have to change this U by also a lambda inverse. And if I compared it along this path, because in going from here to here, I have to use the inverse of this U, which again has the lambda inverse in the right place to cancel that one. So this is what gauge invariance means. It means that if I hit all of the fundamental objects here with a lambda, then I have to hit all of the U's on links coming in and out of this point with either lambdas or lambda inverses, depending on which way they're going. Now, when I come to define the Lagrangian, or the action for this system, if I had these scalar fields, then clearly it could have terms like phi dagger phi, because if I put a lambda on phi, then I put a lambda inverse on phi dagger, and so that doesn't change. It could also have terms like, well, actually this term comes in with a minus, like phi at x, and then the parallel transporter, and then phi at x plus I. This is called the hopping term, and it's the thing that you have to put in so that you have a del phi squared term in the continuum notation happening in your action. And you see that when I perform this gauge transformation, it sticks a lambda here, and it sticks a lambda inverse here, and so this quantity is the same as it had been. So that's gauge invariant. But also there ought to be some contribution to the action from the links themselves, analogous to the f mu nu squared term in the action in the continuum notation. And it also has to be invariant under gauge transformations. Well, why don't I come down here? I'm short. So if I tried to put in something like trace of u, that's no good. It has to be traced because actions have to be scalars. So I can't just put in u. I mean, that's a two-element. What sense does that make in an action? Trace of u is no good because if I stick a lambda there, I've changed it. Okay. And but you see that this guy has also a lambda on him, and so if I put a u dagger and then a u where this is a u on this link and this is the u dagger on this link, then you see when I perform a gauge transformation at this point, a lambda appears here and a lambda inverse appears there, and so this doesn't change. Unfortunately, if I were to perform a gauge transformation here, there would be a lambda twiddle from that gauge transformation and it would change. So this isn't a gauge invariant object, and as long as there's a starting point and an ending point for a sequence of U's that I trace, I'm going to find out that I get gauge dependent on the starting and ending point. But what if I were to pick four U's in a row? Going around in a box. So start here, go here, 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 and trace. Then that quantity is gauge invariant. If I perform a gauge transformation, say at that point it sticks in a lambda inverse lambda from this U and a lambda onto that U, they cancel, that's okay. If I gauge transform at the point that I started walking around here, I stick a lambda here and a lambda inverse there. But since it's a trace, I can just move the lambda inverse over there and they cancel. So this is a gauge invariant quantity. So it's an acceptable thing to have appear in an action. Since it's walking around a square, I call it a placket and denote it as a little square. So I have a sum over all the little squares in the whole lattice of trace of the U's around that square. And that's in 1 plus 1 dimension? Well, I'll come to the fact that I have time in a moment. But basically the answer to the question is if you look at f mu nu squared in 1 plus 1 dimension, Fij is 0, so it's okay. I wasn't supposed to be able to do that. Okay. So far, I'm just thinking about a single time slice. I'll come to time in a moment. Yes, yes, and it will be. Okay, so this is a kind of gauge invariant quantity, and if I laid down a smooth, slowly varying field, I would find out that up to a constant of proportionality, which is something like g squared t over 4 with an a or something like that. This is the same as the b squared over 2 term, which I'm supposed to have in my action. So as long as I have a smoothly varying field, such a term looks like the appropriate term in the action in the continuum theory. So this is a good thing to stick into my action. Okay, and that's going to be the magnetic term in an action. Okay, now, what about time and time update and all that stuff? That's a good question. Well, so far I've told you, well, I've been sort of thinking along the lines of what do you do at a single time. But in real life you have, well, this is a really awful chart. One time slice, and then you have a time slice a little bit higher in time than that one. With little lines linking them, time-like connectors, and, you know, a further slice above that and so forth. Well, those didn't line up very well. Oh, well. So you have, in real life, you have a series of time slices. Okay? And what I want is an action whose variation will give me an equation of motion, which will tell me how to update fields or how to find a solution to the equations of motion. Okay, and the action should be e squared over 2 plus b squared over 2. As we just saw, b squared is the circulation, the what's the word? The curvature. The curvature of the connection around the square. That's what the magnetic field is. So the fact that it's Fij squared, the I and J tell the two directions that I made this box. An electric field is F0i. So this term should involve the time direction. And what it is that... Yes, Minkowski. There's a minus sign. Yeah, I will in a minute. But I mean, there's something to be said here that I want to get to before I do that. Okay, so an electric field means that I take one of these time-like plackets, and the magnetic field means that I take one of these space-like plackets, and I trace them. Okay, so the electric field represents a curvature in one space and time direction, and the magnetic field of curvature in space and space direction. And so on the lattice, I implement these. So this one is then a sum over box ij, a trace box ij. And actually it's minus trace, but this one I'll write as follows. It's a sum of the traces over all time-like boxes. And I put a coefficient in front of it, which essentially allows me... This coefficient could reflect the fact that this distance between lattice sites in space is allowed to be different from this distance between lattice space sites in time. And this delta is the ratio. So this delta is sort of the temporal spacing divided by the spatial spacing, which will always be A. Okay, so putting in this coefficient is a way of controlling those spacings. And I'm going to eventually want to make the spacing so tight that the system behaves like a Hamiltonian system with continuous time. And the reason that I'm going to want to do that is because then I have a almost conserved energy and I can talk almost sensibly about thermodynamics and things like that. But for the moment, let's just look at what happens if I have this as my action. Okay. A question I can ask is if I told you what all of the links are on two of these time-like slices, that sounds like enough initial conditions, that's like specifying a field and its derivative, that you should be able to use classical equations of motion to determine the time evolution of the field. Can I do that from this action and the fact that the action should be extremized over all of my degrees of freedom? So the first thing that you would try to do is, what happens if I vary with respect to one of these space-like links, to say this link? What terms do I get? Well, that variation, that space-like link appears in some terms here, and it appears in some terms here. The terms here it appears in are the ones which correspond to this and this placket. And the terms in here that it corresponds to are the ones, this is getting to be an awful mess. So I'll erase it and start over. So it corresponds to these two time-like pockets, and it also corresponds to this kind of space-like pocket. And there are actually more of these because my chalkboard isn't three-dimensional, so I can't make 40 pictures. When I vary this link, I get some term here and I get some terms here. And in continuum notation, what they look like is that the electric field, which is this link up here, at time t plus delta over 2, and at my position, equals the electric field at the previous. So this placket equals this placket up to some terms which are the variation of these space-like plackets when I vary this link. And it looks just like this equation of motion.
Are you going to work in a not equal zero, or is or not?
I'm going to point out that the update is not unique if I don't choose something like that. I'll come to that in a moment. Okay. So what I've learned, if I knew all of these links, that is, if I knew the previous two time slices, what I learn is the product of these three links. When I vary this, I learn the product of these three links, which is nice. It's not quite what I want, because for every link in this time slice, there's a link underneath it, which will tell me the product of the corresponding three links. But that's almost telling me if I knew these time-like links, then I would know everything, but I still can't quite determine what the future things are just from this. So I say, oh, but I haven't varied all of the equations of motion. There's also an equation of motion associated with this link. So why don't I find out what that tells me? Well, what plackets does this link appear in? It appears in this placket, and the corresponding ones in the other directions. But they're all in the original two time slices, which I know. And when I perform this variation, then what I find out is that the sum of the traces of those plackets varied have to be zero, which is not information about the update, but it's actually a constraint on what is permissible in my original two slices in order for the equations of motion to hold. And that constraint turns out to be, basically, the divergence of the electric field has to be zero. It's Gauss's law, which is that. So I'm reproducing that. But it doesn't tell me anything about the update. All it tells me is, oh, no, you weren't allowed to choose just whatever you wanted for those starting two slices. You had to choose something which satisfied this constraint. And that constraint, incidentally, is preserved by the lattice version of this equation of motion, which is a good thing. But it means that varying the action can't tell me how to update the fields, how to find what the fields are on the next time slice. Not quite. It can tell me over and over products of three links, but it can never tell me the individual links. And actually, it wasn't supposed to be able to do that anyway, because I ought to have the freedom to change the gauge, say, at this point. And if I change the gauge at that point, it changes this link. It hits it by a lambda. It changes this one. It hits it by a lambda inverse. And it changes this one also hitting it with a lambda inverse. And this ought to still be a solution to the equations of motion. And you'll notice that doing that doesn't change what the product of these three links are, because this lambda inverse cancels that lambda. And so this is compatible with the information that I learned from variation of this in this link. Okay, so the update isn't unique, and it shouldn't have been unique, because there should be the freedom to choose the gauge at future times. And if I want to implement this thing, if I want to be able to write down something to determine the links at this future time, then I have to pick some particular choice, and there's no physical content to that choice, and it's not going to affect, what I decide to do isn't going to affect any gauge invariant observables that I want to measure. But I have to make up my mind, and the easiest thing to do is just to set these to the identity. I don't have to, but I may as well. And if this hadn't been the identity, if it had been some U, then I could just choose the gauge transformation here to be lambda equals that U, and then this would be hit by a lambda inverse, and it would become the identity. So I have the ability to make these the identity, and I do so. And if I do so, then knowing the product of these three means that I know this one. So the path
U is equal to one?
Yeah, U equals identity. No, this U connecting the two slices I know to the next slice.
U is higher than the original slice.
Yeah, I'm choosing A naught equals zero.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm doing. Yeah, this is the most convenient. I don't have to do that. I could choose it to be whatever I want it to be, but I have to choose it to be something, and this is the most convenient thing to choose from the standpoint of just writing down something that works. Having done so, I get something which are Yang-Mills equations with an auxiliary gauge condition which renders the update unique. And then I have something that I can play with. And as I said, I could have chosen something different. I just choose to do that because it's the easiest thing. Okay. And now my next trick is to squeeze the spacing to be very small so that the update becomes approximately continuous. And then I can think in terms of this as being a Hamiltonian system. The electric field, which is actually, as you saw, this placket, becomes, for all intents and purposes, an adjoint valued field living on this link. Okay. So when I squeeze the time direction towards zero, then I have a system which at a fixed time looks like this, and on every link there is a U and there is an E. And the E I could choose to define as an adjoint valued object living here, or an adjoint valued object living here, depending on my tastes. The difference is commuting it with the U. So if I define it here, and then somebody else wanted to define it here and asks what the value is, then I would have to take that, because this is an adjoint valued object. So after I make the time spacing almost continuous, then I have a system where the degrees of freedom are a parallel transporter and an electric field on each link, and the updates are lattice analogs of this and this. And now I have discretized my system in a way which is an infrared regulation of those equations.
What's happening at the boundary?
I use periodic boundaries, so I don't have to worry about it. Yeah. There's a question, what do I do at initial time? However, as I said, this could be considered a Hamiltonian system. The Hamiltonian is a sum over all the plackets of trace placket again, the sum, plus a sum over all the electric fields of E squared over 2 trace, which I guess uses up the 2. And there are factors I'm not remembering to include, but like 2s, so don't worry about 2s. And then I could say, well, this has a well-defined thermodynamics, e to the minus beta h being a partition, that thing. And then I could draw a configuration under this weight, and there are algorithms for doing so, which are actually typically very similar to evolving these equations. But you use the fact these electric fields are Gaussian modulo the constraints to give you some handle that you can twiddle and put heat into the system. So I can choose starting conditions which are thermal, and then I have a completely well-specified program that I'm doing. Except that so far this J and this rho are zero. And now I should ask, does this theory look like what I want it to look like? And the answer is mostly, but not entirely. There's one problem, which is that if I had this thing unregulated, then these equations have UV divergences in them. Those UV divergences are still present. That's potentially a problem. They look almost just like a term that looks like this and a term that looks like this. And I can hide them by sticking in these terms the coefficients, which are so big that they cover up the lattice ones, and that's going to be my philosophy. But there's another potential little bug in this system, which I should mention, which is that I said that if I have a slowly, smoothly varying field, that this trace box looks like a magnetic field. But if I have a very, very quickly varying field, it doesn't. And this is similar to the old problem of trying to write phi dagger del squared phi in a scalar field where you only know phi at a fixed number of points. If I write this as being, oh, what is it? 2 phi squared minus some. If I write it as, is the 2 right? No. Oh, if I put it over 2 here, then the 2 is, yeah, there. Okay. So if I tried to discretize the del squared operator, the easiest thing is to say del squared is neighbors minus twice the center point. And it's well known that this discretization doesn't actually give del squared. It actually gives del squared minus 1/12 del to the fourth plus blah, blah, blah. Okay. And there's an A squared here if you keep track of lattice spacings, where A is the spacing between these. And something very similar happens in this case. This trace box doesn't actually give you F squared. It doesn't actually give you B squared. It could have corrections of form a form like that. Actually, whatever. This isn't exactly what it looks like. It's actually Fij and Fij, except that this is a minus. But anyway, it can give you derivative corrections to what it's supposed to be. It has to be cubic symmetric. It is, they do not have to be O3 symmetric. And they won't be O3 symmetric. Okay. So what do the actual dispersion relations look like of this theory? The dispersion relations are supposed to be that omega squared as a function of k is omega squared equals k squared. So that should be a parabola. And if I use this action, it turns out, I won't go through all the grubby details, that it's not a parabola. It's 4 sine squared sum over I, ki a over 2 with a 1 over a squared in front. Which you can now expand and find that at leading order it is k squared, but then there's a minus a squared over 12 sum over I of ki to the fourth, which is not O3 invariant, and higher terms a to the fourth, etc. So the dispersion relation looks like this. And in fact, this is completely inevitable because I'm on a lattice here. And the dispersion relation has to be defined on a Brillouin zone. Sorry, Brillouin zone. I'm in Quebec now, so I'm supposed to know these things. And it has to match up at the boundary of the Brillouin zone. So that was something that had to be screwed up. Okay. And that means that the dispersion relations have these funny little wrong pieces. And there's something even worse, which is that this is a gauge theory with an exact gauge invariance. And you know that the expression isn't really del A squared, which is giving you the dispersion relation. It's really dA squared. And so there are some vertices which are associated with it being a parabola in the original thing. And that means that when it curves, there are going to be some vertices associated with it not being a parabola. So if you wanted to write what the action must look like for this to be the dispersion relation, you would have to say that it's something like dA squared plus ddA. And now I'm thinking sort of cryptically in a symbolic way, so it's not exactly this. This is going to give you vertices which look like that, where there's a k, and like this. This is going to give you vertices where there's a correction to this vertex k cubed, and there's a correction to this vertex k squared, and there are five and higher point vertices. But they're all suppressed formally by powers as lattice spacing. Unless you're talking about the ultraviolet behavior of the theory, it's okay. So the story is that if there were only infrared fluctuations, then I would have a theory which looks just right. In fact, when you look at what the ultraviolet fluctuations do, it turns out to be pretty screwed up, and it has to be pretty screwed up. And there are things that I could do so that the screwing up arises at a higher value of momentum, but there's nothing I can do to prevent the screwing up from happening ever. And the results, among other things, are that when you write e to the minus beta h, there's some radiative correction to that beta, which is computable. But as we'll see later, the dispersion relation being funny is perhaps a real problem when I try to add this and this term.
So
I'll go into that.
The
improved lattice action is a way of getting rid of this term in this expansion by making this dispersion relation hold tighter to the parabola for longer, but it always ends up turning over. And an aside which perhaps I should make, it is possible to improve this lattice action too, and I've done it, and I'm never going to do it again because it is bad. And the reason it's bad is because it's not sufficient. You can do that by, in addition to using these square guys, using these rectangular guys. And this is done in QCD all the time nowadays. And this is, if you ever go to a talk by Peter Lepage, he'll thump the pulpit about this.
Okay. People have done all of the 4-dimensional hypercubes.
All kinds of things. Everything you can think of. Everything you can think of. Okay. However, in this context, as I said, really we're in space-time. So this is time. Okay. And it's not enough just to use rectangles in these spatial planes. You also have to use rectangles in these time planes. And then when I vary the equation of motion on this link, it cares about this and this. So that, if you will, A at t plus delta, it's now given by some kind of an operator, a linear operator, approximately linear operator, of the A's of t. Previously, this linear operator was diagonal, and now it isn't. Or, no, wait, I'm writing this backwards. The operator is over here, and previously it was diagonal, and now it isn't, and I have to invert it. And that's an awful pain. Yes, absolutely. Because the spacing and time being smaller means you don't have to include these ones. It doesn't mean you don't have to include these ones. If you will, if you didn't include these, you would be getting b squared just right. Your db squared term would be vanishing. But your e squared would still have a die squared correction, which you aren't getting rid of. Okay. Having to include these would correspond to z0e squared correction. And this is suppressed by this much smaller spacing, so it's okay. Which turns out to be good, because if you try to put this in, you get an unstable algorithm. That's another story. But this you have to get rid of by including those, and then the update involves inversion of a linear operator, approximately linear operator. It's a nightmare. So I'm not going to do it. It can be done. I won't. Well, I did, and now I know better. Okay. So that is how to do the Yang-Mills equations. If there are any further questions, be happy to ask them now, because I'm about to get to the even grungier stuff.
You said constantly about infrared field. Does it mean that the lattice spacing is like 1 over the temperature? I mean, do you have to forget?
I stick in a number, which I call beta, which is 4 over GB. squared AT. This is the thing I get to choose, is this beta. So my lattice spacing is then G squared T over is then 4 over G squared T, spatial spacing, times 1 over this beta. So the way I vary my lattice spacing is in units of of 1 over G squared T, I have a number, which is a pure number, which I can stick in to determine the lattice spacing.
And how do you know that it's still infrared?
I mean what do you mean, what's infrared?
Well, the field, you said it should be,
if the physics...
Wrong, if you choose the number wrong, you're not...
Yeah, if the physics involves scales, 4 over G squared T, then setting A smaller than A, than 1, then setting this beta larger than 1 would have that physics be slowly varying on my lattice. If the physics involves not 4 over G squared T, but 1 over G squared T, then choosing beta larger than 4 would mean that that physics is slowly varying on my lattice. I don't a priori know how big beta needs to be to capture stuff. That's, of course, one of the things that I'll play with. I would say it seems that if this is bigger than 6, then you're not doing so bad, is what it turns out. The strict statement is the following. I really have a whole lot of scales that I'm trying to represent at once. There are some which are of order the temperature, and I don't want them to be represented on the lattice. I do want the lattice to represent the ones at the G squared T scale and some ones to the ultraviolet of that, so that I have a nice safe margin and I know that the lattice isn't screwing up at the scale I'm most interested in. As long as I choose beta to be small enough, A to be big enough, then I know that I'm not including the very hard stuff which isn't classical. In which case, the things I'm including, I'm using the correct statistics, which are... A is being squeezed. It has to be small enough that the stuff I'm interested in is smooth. It has to be big enough that I'm not having ultraviolet, truly ultraviolet in the sense that it should no longer be classical. Stuff being represented as classical. Yeah. So in a sense, you don't want A to be too, you don't want beta to be too big, you don't want A to be too small either, because then you're treating as classical things which aren't. Okay. But...
So you are in a terrible position because when A cannot be too small, so A has to be big, that means you are...
It's not big, but not too small.
That means that you're full of lattice out.
The correct statement is the following. I try to choose A so that the lattice artifacts fall at some scale which turns out to be unimportant to the physics I'm interested in, which I believe is a scale intermediate between GT and T. So 1 over A should be somewhere in here. Okay. And you see, if it's up here, then it's not screwing up my very infrared physics that I care about and love. It's not even screwing up my screening physics. But it's not yet treating as classical things which aren't. So if I stick it somewhere in there, then I feel sort of okay about myself. And then this stuff, I integrate out and represent as these terms, which I'm hoping I'll be able to get to now.
If you put your paper.
Okay, I want to push on because we're not going to finish.
But there's something else that bothers me. I mean, you made a long presentation about how you derive the right theory on the lattice. Okay? And there's something that bothers me about that. That's the following. You chose a very small function.
Okay. Yeah.
However, of course, that potentially introduces a lot of trouble because if the time step is much smaller than the spatial
set. I screwed up Lorentz invariants.
You screwed up Lorentz invariants anyway because you have a cubic Lorentz invariant, but you actually can have propagation of modes that are much faster than speed of light.
No, modes propagate slower than...
You're lucky because you have modes that propagate actually are all propagating slower than the speed of light.
Yeah.
But you couple that is fine at a much faster speed.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, but this never turns out to be a problem.
Right. Now, however, there is a physics issue here that somehow makes me wonder why that is really a good approach, because we know that the time scale that you want to represent actually is much longer than.
Okay, well, okay, the statement. Okay, the statement's true. Well, give me a simpler effective theory which I can believe to be better than leading log, and I'll use it. Okay. But, okay, so the statement you're making is if I have some phenomenon here, it ought to be that information propagates from that phenomenon along and inside of the light cone. But, in fact, if I have a smaller time spacing than spatial spacing, information can propagate as fast as you want. Okay. However, that's true. So information propagates all in here. But if you look at the amount of information in here, it's exponentially small. So it's okay. I'm not worried about it.
In order to study our numerical evolution, you really have to use A. B, C should be smaller. Than
yeah. Okay. Okay. So now I'm going to add these terms. So there. Okay. So let me draw my lattice again. The idea is going to be, as I argue, you can think of those terms as corresponding to there being a whole bunch of particles running around, moving in almost straight lines, a bath of particles getting polarized by electric fields, and then flying in almost straight lines to lead to currents somewhere else. So the idea for the implementation is that I'll stick down a whole bunch of particles flying around, insist that I have a Hamiltonian system, figure out how that Hamiltonian system works, and then look at it and see whether it correctly reproduces these terms, which it will. I'll come to that. Yes, it does, only in that it changes the Debye mass.
So that means that it moves not under the dissipated speed, but
yeah. Yeah. It just changes the Debye mass. And I won't be able to go through all the details of that derivation because it's awful. It's much simpler in the theory Kari's going to talk about. But it does just change the Debye mass. Okay. So in addition to the degrees of freedom, which I've already discussed, now I'm really going to need the colored chalk. I'm going to move it down to where I am. I'm going to add a bunch of new degrees of freedom, which are intended. So the idea is that this is a non-local effect. It has an integral over a past light cone. If I try to put that in directly, I will have a non-local theory, which is a nightmare. So what I do is I put in some degrees of freedom, which if I integrated out would look like this, but which give me a local theory. Okay, and I'm going to check when I'm done to see that I get those this behavior for the degrees of freedom I'm adding. Okay, and the idea of the degrees of freedom I'm adding is that these correspond to the behavior of a whole bunch of charged particles running around the lattice, so that's exactly what I'm going to add. A bunch of charged particles, which take spaces, which take positions which are continuous on the lattice. And in practice, it turns out I'm going to need something like 30 or more of them per lattice volume. Okay. And each one of these guys is going to have associated with it a momentum, P, which is its kinetic momentum, so it's a gauge invariant quantity. It's going to have a charge, Q, satisfying, it's in the a joint representation and trace and Q squared is going to be some Q squared, which is a parameter of this theory that I'm constructing. It's going to have a position psi. I think I better stick with index notation. So this is its position. And it's going to have an energy E equals magnitude of P. Okay. And this relation says that I'm considering them to be ultra-relativistic. And a further relation that psi dot is going to be always pi over e says that they move as ultra-relativistic objects. And now what remains is to figure out how they're supposed to interact with my fields. And those interactions are going to be guided by the conditions that I want. I want Gauss's law to stay true. I want Hamiltonian, which is the sum of the momenta of these particles, plus the Hamiltonian for just the lattice degrees of freedom. And this should be conserved. and I want to be there some measure on the phase space, the space of all positions, charges, and momenta of the particles, and values of all of the fields, which is conserved. Conserved in the sense of...
But I thought you already said it. You said Hamilton.
Well, I said, okay, think of this as... I want there to be an energy which is conserved. Having a conserved energy is not sufficient to say that I have a Hamiltonian system.
You have a Hamiltonian, then. Energy is automatic.
Yeah, but okay, if I had a Hamiltonian and I was deriving equations of motion from it, then I could say, oh, of course, everything is fine.
Yes.
Actually, what I have is an idea of what the energy should be, and I'm trying to figure out what the equations of motion are by some ad hoc technique. And then I'm going to be guided in constructing that ad hoc technique by ensuring a conservation of some energy and the measure, which will say that I could have thought, you know, I could have figured out some Hamiltonian, which gave me the thing that I have.
Isn't that anything to the conception thing?
It turns... Okay, normally that is the statement that the momentum which appears in... See, how do you say that? It's the kinetic momentum which is appearing in the Hamiltonian. The actual momentum is a canonical momentum which includes the gauge field, and the interaction is hidden in there. But I'm only going to keep track of the kinetic momentum because maintaining gauge invariants is just easiest to do that way. It's just the way to do it, basically. Okay. No idea. I just wanted the thing to work. I don't want to understand every detail.
Okay. They are in this electric.
Well, yeah, okay, but that is... No, the potential term is that there's an E squared here, and that they appear in Gauss's law and therefore force there to be electric fields. And that actually takes care of it. This is exactly the thing that you would do in continuum boring old classical electromagnetism plus particles in order... Yeah, it's you know, look it up in chapter 1 of Itzigsohn and Zubair.
Okay. The hard particles don't interact with themselves. They
do interact with each other
via electromagnetic
fields, which is the way that they're supposed to. So it means that I'm dropping hard scatterings, which are in any case subdominant, so that's okay. Okay, so let's figure out what's happening. First, I said I want Gauss's law to be true. But what is Gauss's law? Gauss's law, as we saw, is a statement which there's one Gauss expression for each lattice site. Okay, so Gauss's law is a statement that the electric fields on the links going out from this lattice site, considered as adjoint objects at that site, sum to zero. But now I have a bunch of charges. It seems like they ought to sum to the charge, and I have to tell you what I mean the charge to be. So the most obvious thing for the charge to be is that you draw the... that's not a different enough color. That's a good, really vibrant... Come on. But I already used that. Well, I'll use it again. Who cares? You draw the dual lattice, which shows you what the regions are which are closest to each vertex of the original lattice. So this region is all the space which is closest to that point. Now what I say is the charge, which should appear in Gauss's law, is the sum of these charges of all the particles which happen to fall inside of that box. Okay. So now I've told you what Gauss's law is. Rho equals sum in box of QA. Okay, so that now uniquely specifies what I mean by Gauss's law. Okay, and I could think of starting out with initial conditions so that Gauss's law is satisfied. And now I'm going to have to make sure that I have equations of motion which preserve its being satisfied, so which commute with Gauss's law. And basically what that's going to mean is that this rho and this j have to form a conserved current, which is going to specify what this j has to be. And the way to see what's happening is, supposing I had this particle moving, which it does because, again, there's this psi dot, this p over e, and it has some momentum. So it'll move, and at some time, it'll cross this dual lattice cell and cease being a charge in this box and start being a charge in this box. When it does that, the charge in this box abruptly drops, and therefore the sum of electric fields going out of this box abruptly drops, or needs to abruptly drop for Gauss's law to stay true. And the way to do that is that you abruptly change the electric field along this link. So you add to the electric field on this link a change which is minus the charge of the particle. Okay. If you do that at the exact moment that the particle crosses this boundary, then Gauss's law will stay true. Doing that is just saying what this J appearing in this equation of motion is. It is a delta function every time a particle crosses a boundary of magnitude minus the charge of that particle times the direction of crossing.
The electric field based where?
That's a good question. The charge initially parallel transported is an object at this point. So the electric field considered as something that parallel transports at this point gets changed by the charge considered as something that parallel transports at that point. Now the electric field I could also consider to parallel transport at this point. Therefore, after this particle crosses the box, I should parallel transport his charge, which I was supposed to do anyway because it's going to give me this parallel transporter in this expression here.
So in principle, the dual lattice size doesn't have to be the same as the original lattice size. I mean, because that only depends on the particle. So I could have made it bigger and get a smoother behavior.
No. This link has to be associated with this dual lattice face. If I try to make this box around this guy a little bit bigger, it's eating into the boxes in the neighboring places.
But what? As long as I just have we're dealing with that point,
Okay. You could try to do the following. You could say that as a particle gets close to this boundary, I'll associate most of its charge with this point and a little bit of its charge with that point.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you
okay.
in Abelian case. Right?
Yeah, and in the Abelian case, you can get away with it because the charge doesn't parallel transport when you cross the box. But in this case, it does parallel transport when you cross the box.
Uh-huh.
And if this link is evolving, then the part of the charge which is over here is evolving differently than the part here, and it turns out that the magnitude of the charge is no longer conserved. So you can't do that.
But it's completely equivalent to actually, when you do it right, it's completely equivalent to taking more charges of a smaller magnitude, right? More particles with a smaller charge.
No, but the total charge associated with a particle I'd like to be a conserved quantity. I would think it was a very strange theory if it weren't. And if I tried to spread the charge out, then the fact that it's in a joint object and the underlying fields are evolving means that I get in trouble. Similarly, if I'm going to parallel transport it using this parallel transporter, I have to change the corresponding electric field. If I thought I would be sneaky and try to do something a little smoother and change, also have a little bit of the field go by that path instead of by this path. This is different than this because there's a box here, and parallel transportation around that box isn't there's a magnetic field which doesn't commute with this electric field. So the electric fields wouldn't add up in the correct way, and Gauss's law would be violated. Unless, and this is a possibility which we neglected in our paper, unless I also parallel transported pieces of the charge also via that circuit instead of via that circuit. And you can do that, and it makes the update extremely complicated. And as I'll discuss, there might be reasons that you should do that. But for right now, I'm not going to. I'm just going to parallel transport it the easiest way, which is using this parallel transporter. Okay, I'm coming to the Lorentz force. I can't do everything at once.
It's 10 to 11, so I'm just wondering.
I'm hurrying! I'm hurrying too much, you see? And it's not your fault. Okay. No, I'm trying, okay? Let me try to finish this, because it's closer to finish than it sounds like it is. There, am I still alive? Okay. It's closer to finish than it sounds like it is. I've done that, and now I have to do those two. Okay, so... Yeah, so the next statement is that when I abruptly change this electric field, I've changed one of the terms in this H. namely, this has a sum of b squared over 2. Okay, and now I've abruptly changed that by roughly eq. Okay? So I've changed my energy. I have to change some other energy to keep energy conserved. And, well, since it's this goddamn particle which changed that energy, the most natural thing to do is to change the energy of that particle to keep the energy conserved. And you see, at leading order, I have to, at leading order, I have to change it by E dot Q. And if I think of this E as the average between the just before and the just after E, then this is exactly the amount I need to change its energy by. Okay. That means that I have to change its P. So how should I change its P? And the answer is that when you consider that the measure has to be conserved, its P goes to Pi plus delta I with J, where J is the direction of the electric field that I'm crossing, and then something which is approximately EJQ P over PJ. Okay, so I have to change its momentum to make the energy conserved. It turns out I do have to change its momentum, and I have to change only the component of its momentum in the direction of this electric field, both of those because of the conservation of measure. And it uniquely specifies how much I have to change its momentum. And the amount is exactly the amount which, if I had a slowly varying field and I considered a series of these crossings, would give me the Lorentz force law for the particle.
So again, you're going to get Lorentz for the Wong's equation.
Exactly. Except, yeah, the Wong's equation, but the interactions are all discrete. They happen each time you cross one of these things. Okay. And now there's one thing which might look slightly funny about what I've done, which is that if you look at how it's changing the electric field and you imagine for a moment that the electric field, that the field just sat there while the particle is moving, then as a particle comes streaming along here, it induces electric field sort of running along in its it induces electric field pointing back in the opposite direction, running along its path of motion. On the other hand, if you thought about continuum Yang-Mills fields or electromagnetic fields, and you've turned off for a moment the ability of the fields to evolve, and you moved a particle along, a particle which starts out having these electric field lines pointing out from it, as you pulled it along, since the fields weren't allowed to evolve, its lines would all be stuck in this little tube running along behind it, which looks exactly like this. And when you allow the fields to evolve, then they know, you know, they have time to respond and stretch out, and they give you the familiar, or hopefully not familiar, Lienert-Bickert potential around this particle. And the same thing will happen. The electromagnetic fields here will be able to stretch out, and they'll give you a Lienert-Bickert-like field around this moving particle.
But then one situation has also magnetic field.
One thing I didn't mention is that the update is not quite unique. I'm allowed to perform a rotation on the momentum. It doesn't change this. It doesn't change the measure, provided that I have some C odd, P odd field about which to rotate, which I can choose to be the local magnetic field. However, it turns out whether or not you do so doesn't alter whether you get these correct equations. Since I don't really want the particles necessarily to represent what particles truly do, I'm happy enough for the particles to just give me these effects, I cannot bother to implement their rotation under a magnetic field. And that's the choice of least effort. So we foolishly didn't follow it and then changed our minds and do follow it. Yeah, okay, so I've defined the system. Why don't we take a little break, and then I'll explain why it's giving these, and then Kari will tell an alternative way of constructing such a thing. And then I guess we're done. Is that acceptable before the Allah?
Well, I didn't think it was a long time. Okay. It's when people want to go to lunch.
Yes.
Well,
okay, so
I can be finished in a half.
Okay.
Okay, so a quick remark, and then I'll tell you why I get these equations. So the quick remark is, as I said, I can show that this is a Hamiltonian system. It has a conserved measure and energy. And then I can ask what are its thermodynamics. I had this parameter Q, capital Q, where little q A squared summed over A equals the capital Q squared. If I make this parameter small, then it turns out that the thermodynamics are exactly the thermodynamics before I added the particles, except with an addition to the Debye mass. I'm not going to go through that because it's a pain. And furthermore, the momenta of the particles are distributed always, no matter what this charge is, exactly Boltzmann distributed. And that actually is the way that we can thermalize the system very easily. You just choose those to be Boltzmann, evolve it for a while, throw them away, and choose them Boltzmann again. Okay, but now I should show you why you get the appropriate... Well, I'm going to do slightly fast and loose derivation that I get this term. Okay. So supposing that I have some link here, and it has its dual lattice face there, and I ask, what should I expect this current to be? Well, it's a flux of particles through this link. And if I were in equilibrium and nothing else had ever happened, then I'd expect that there wouldn't be any reason why more particles would be coming through in one direction than in the other. But supposing I knew that over here, at some previous time, there had been an electric field pointing in that direction, then I know what it would have done is all the particles which went through that dual lattice space, which had one charge, would have been accelerated, and the ones with the other charge would have been decelerated. And therefore, there would be an excess going through there with a particular charge. That excess would be proportional to this electric field. So there's an excess, which is proportional to
excess of
one charge, say Q equals plus. Okay, if this electric field is in the plus of the algebra direction, there's an excess of charges with a plus sign, which is proportional to the electric field. Okay? Now I ask, how many of those particles go through here? And therefore, how much excess current does this box get due to there having been that electric field? And the answer is that is the solid angle which you see from this guy, the solid angle of that dual lattice face that I see from over here, times the geometric factor that if you're going in that direction, this guy also looks like it has a reduced surface area. Okay? Solid angle, as you know, falls as 1 over r squared. So that gives me this. As this dual lattice face becomes less and less orthogonal to the direction of propagation of these particles, I get less and less, and that gives me this. As this dual lattice face becomes less and less orthogonal to this direction of propagation, I get less and less, and that gives me this term. So that explains this term here. Okay? This n to I squared over 4 pi turns out to be a counting of how many particles I have and how easy it is to bend what direction they're going. And on the lattice, it turns out to be this charge squared times the number density of the particles times the inverse lattice temperature divided by, I think it's 3. Is it 3? You remember. Yeah, it's 3. It's just some number. Okay. So basically, it's counting the Q squared is here because it tells how easy it is to bend this guy and how much he influences this guy. That's one Q from bending him and one Q from his arrival. The N is how many of these guys there were to be bent to begin with. I'm making an approximation that it flies in an almost straight line on the way, which is true if this charge is small enough that the kicks it receives en route are small. But as long as I keep this Q squared times N fixed, as I make my Q squared small, then I can keep the same physical Debye mass squared and actually arrive at that limit. Okay. Now there are two other terms here. There's this propagator, U, and there's this electric field. The integral over all space is obvious because every link with an electric field could be sending me particles to here. This U is the fact that when I had my particle go from being in this box to this box, its charge got acted on by a parallel transporter. So on the way from here to here, it gets acted on by a series of parallel transporters all along its trajectory, and that gives you this UAB, which also makes this quantity gauge invariant, and this electric field is just that the excess of charges is proportional to how hard they are being kicked. So this expression is correctly reproduced, modulo a few very slight comments. The first comment is the retardation of the time. I could have a particle go through the near end of this dual lattice space and arrive at the near end of that. I could have one go through the far end of this lattice space and arrive at the far end of that one. This one would take slightly longer to propagate. So actually, their retardation time is an integral over a narrow range of retardation times in practice on the lattice. But the width of that range of retardation times is the lattice spacing, which is small and will lead to a very small error in your correctly reproducing this effect. Also, this parallel transporter could be slightly different from a guy who starts from one end of this box than from a guy who starts from the other end of this box. So this is actually slightly averaged over a couple of different ways to perform the parallel transportation from there to there. But again, that's a very minor issue. So you correctly reproduce this term, modulo corrections of order the lattice spacing.
Is that the density has to be like 30 particles in the system? So that's given by that.
The density is that there's some Debye mass squared I want to arrive at. I need to make the charge small so that it doesn't get significantly kicked on the way. Okay. And now I want to comment, hopefully briefly, on the fact that these guys get kicked more than you would have thought they get kicked. Okay. And the reason is a funny reason. I said as this guy propagates along, it leaves electric fields sort of in its wake, and that those electric fields propagate and give you the Lehner-Beeker potential, which you expect. But it turns out they don't quite give you the Lehner-Beeker potential. And from the point of view of the me who implemented these particles, it's not my fault. It's the fault of this discretization being screwed up in the most ultraviolet region. I showed you this dispersion relation for the lattice classical fields propagation, omega squared against k, curved and flattened off. If you calculate then the speed of light as a function of k, the speed of actual propagation of light, not the speed of light, it's correct until you get out here and then it falls down to zero. So the most ultraviolet lattice modes have subluminal propagation. And that means that this charge is moving superluminally with respect to them. And you know what happens when you make a charge move superluminally? It Cherenkov radiates. And these guys Cherenkov radiate. And that means that their interaction with the lattice fields is more intense in the ultraviolet than it's supposed to be. And you can understand the fact that they Cherenkov radiate by thinking about this diagram, emission. Can that happen on shell? Normally, no. Just because, you know, this has some momentum, this has some momentum, this has some momentum. And there's no way of making both the vector and the energy add up in this thing and have all these guys be on shell. But if this guy has k greater than his omega, then I can have the vectors and the energies add up and still be on shell. So this emission is kinematically allowed and it happens. And it dominates the energy loss of these particles. It dominates their getting scattered. And it forces me to a small value of this charge. Of course, the inverse process is also possible. That's the statement that these modes are Landau damped. It's not surprising that they're Landau damped. I have this beautiful, basically correct hard thermal loop contribution, which means that I have a propagator which looks like 1 over omega squared minus plus the self-energy. I'm getting signs wrong as usual. This self-energy does what it's supposed to be. Minus, instead of k squared, there's this 1 over a squared, 4 over a squared sine ka of 2 thing. This is this curve rather than the parabola. And it means that the actual pole, the on-shell pole at some k, is at an omega which is less than k. It's less than it's supposed to be. And there's a Landau cut which extends from omega equals k to omega equals minus k, and the pole actually falls inside of the cut because I have screwed up lattice dispersion relation. The cut is where it's supposed to be because I have a correct relativistically propagating thing inducing the hard thermal loops. So this pi is what it should be. But the pi being what it should be means that my most ultraviolet modes actually have dissipative propagation. This is lambda damping. Which, in a way, turns out to be good. Well, let me not go into that. I think this says that there are some nice and some bad things about this way of implementing hard thermal loops. And having said that, I think I'll let Kari discuss an alternative way of implementing them, which has different nice and bad things. The nice thing is that I really get the correct self-energy beautifully. This term really looks exactly like it's supposed to look. But the bad thing is maybe I didn't really want it to.
Now, wait a minute. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
The nice thing could be that the short wavelength gauge fields are more than because of these lambda. So that's not what you'd like to.
Yeah, then they don't contribute to hard thermal loops. That's right.